This week on Making Contact.
Is a forest a sacred grove or simply lumber and pulp? Is a river the circulatory system of the land, or is it simply an opportunity for power or irrigation? The way we see the world shapes the way that we treat it.
Author, radio host, and scientist David Suzuki has spent a lifetime working to protect the environment. But he says that work is failing and a paradigm shift is needed to keep the health of our species and our planet intact.
So let's put the eco back into economics.
On this edition, David Suzuki speaks on how we need to stop fighting and use the laws of nature as a starting point for moving forward. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
I want to speak to you today as an elder. You see, at my age, no one can accuse me of having a drive for power or money or fame. Anybody who's an elder that's still after that, he's got a problem, I would think. And now that testosterone levels are dropping, so I don't think about sex all the time, I'm getting really smart. I believe elders have a very special place because we have something no other group in society has. We have had the experience of living an entire lifetime. Elders have suffered setbacks, I'm sure. We've made a lot of mistakes, celebrated a few successes. Our lives are full of lessons, lessons vital to pass on to the coming generation. So I urge my fellow elders to get off the couch, get off the golf course, and get on with the most important part of your lives. You see, we are at a remarkable moment in all of human history, when what we do or do not do in the next few years will determine whether our species will survive into the next century. Let me give you one example of the kind of warnings that we've been receiving. This is a document that was published in November of 1992. It's called World Scientists Warning to Humanity. And when you look at the list of scientists, these are the top scientists of the world, more than 1,700 scientists from 71 countries in the world, including over half of all living Nobel Prize winners at that time. So it's a pretty impressive group of people. What are they warning us about in 1992? Let me read you from the document. Human beings and the natural world are on a collision course. Human activities inflict harsh and often irreversible damage on the environment and on critical resources. If not checked, many of our current practices put at serious risk the future we wish for human society and may so alter the living world that it will be unable to sustain life in the manner that we know. Fundamental changes are urgent if we are to avoid the collision our present course will bring about. And then they go on and list the areas of collision: the atmosphere, water resources, oceans, soil, forests, species, and population. And then the words grow even more bleak. No more than one or a few decades remain before the chance to avert the threats we now confront will be lost, and the prospects for humanity immeasurably diminished. A great change in our stewardship of the earth and life on it is required if vast human misery is to be avoided and our global home on this planet is not to be irretrievably mutilated. And then they tell us the five things that we must do and begin immediately. This is a frightening document. But I'll tell you, scientists are not in the business of signing such strongly worded documents. But if this is frightening, the response of the media around the world was terrifying. There was no response. In Canada, our national newspaper and our national broadcaster, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, dismissed this as not newsworthy. Excuse me, over half of all Nobel Prize winners, saying we may have as little as 10 years to avoid a catastrophe, and this is not newsworthy. And let's remind ourselves of what is newsworthy. You ever heard of Brad and Angelina? You ever heard of Lindsay Lohan? Think of the sports, Lance Armstrong and who won the World Series. And of course, every pronouncement from an economist or a corporate executive is reported in breathless detail, but not when half of all Nobel Prize winners tell us we face a catastrophe. Why in the world can't we see what's happening? The powerful position we've acquired and the warnings of the leading scientists of the world about the dangers that we now confront, especially in the area of global warming. Well, I believe the problem is that the way we see the world, we see the world through the perspective of our values and our beliefs. And it is our current worldview, that perspective today, that is the cause of our destructiveness. Many years ago, I visited a tiny village on the side of a mountain in the Andes in Peru. And I learned that the children in this village are taught that the mountain their village is on is an apu. Apu in their language means God. And as long as that apu casts its shadow on the village, it will determine the destiny of everyone in that village. And I thought, wow, imagine the way those kids, when they grow up, treat that mountain compared to someone from Gunnison, Colorado, who grows up in the Rockies, taught all his life that those mountains are full of gold or silver. Is a forest a sacred grove or simply lumber and pulp? Is a river the circulatory system of the land, or is it simply an opportunity for power or irrigation? Is another species our biological relative or simply a resource? Is the soil a community of organisms or just dirt? Is the biosphere our home or is it simply an opportunity? The way we see the world shapes the way that we treat it. For 95% of human existence, we were nomadic hunter-gatherers. And when you're a nomad following plants and animals through the seasons, you know very, very well that we are utterly dependent on the natural world for our survival and well-being. So for most of human existence, we understood our place in nature and our dependence on nature. In the last 5% of our existence, the last 10,000 years, we had the agricultural revolution that transformed the way that humanity lives. For most of that last 10,000 years, we've been a farming species. In 1900, when there were 1.5 billion people in the world, most people in the world, including in North America, lived in rural village communities. You could find all through the Midwest tiny communities of 150, 200 people living, spotted all across the Midwest. Why? Because we were farmers. Because most people in the world were involved in some aspect of agriculture. Farmers understand very well the seasons, weather, climate. We're utterly dependent on these for our well-being and our survival. Farmers know the amount of snow in the winter is directly related to the amount of moisture in the soil in the summer. Farmers know some insects are pests, but we need insects to pollinate flowering plants. They know that some species of plants and trees take nitrogen from the air, fix it as fertilizer in the soil. Farmers understand that we are dependent on the natural world. Something fundamentally different happened in the last 100 years. By the year 2000, when there were now 6 billion people in the world, 80 to 85% of us living in the industrialized countries now lived in big cities. Over half of all of humanity by the year 2000 lived in cities. So in only 100 years, we were changed from a farming animal into a big city dweller. And in a big city, it becomes easy to think we're not like other species. I mean, we're so smart, we create our own habitat. You know, and as long as we have a few parks out there where we can go camping and skiing and playing, who needs nature? You know, we're city folk. I have a friend that lives in the northern end of Toronto, biggest city in Canada. And he told me he lives in a high-rise apartment, completely air-conditioned. He said, I go down the elevator in the morning, get into my car in the basement, it's completely air-conditioned, drive down the Down Valley Freeway downtown into the basement of my commercial building, into an air-conditioned office. That building is connected through tunnels to all kinds of shopping areas and food markets. He said to me, David, I don't have to go outside for weeks. Who needs nature? We create our own habitat. And so as city dwellers, our highest priority becomes our job. We need a job to earn the money to buy the things that we want. Note I said want, not need, because most of the stuff we buy we don't need. It's just what we want. And so the economy then becomes our priority as an urban species. Now, we seem to forget that the very word economy comes from the Greek word oikos, meaning household or domain. Our domain as a species is the biosphere, the zone of air, water, and land where all living things exist. Economics is the management of our domain. Ecology comes from the same root word, and ecology is the study of our domain or our household. And what ecologists try to do is determine what are the conditions, the principles, and the laws that enable a species to survive and flourish. Now, I would have thought any organization, any corporation, any government, before beginning a new program, would say, wait a minute now, have you checked with those ecologists? Because we don't want to do anything that's going to violate those principles or those laws. But what we do is we say, no, 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 we can't afford to do that. The economy then becomes even more important than the very principles that ecologists are telling us about. We elevate the economy when we say, we can't afford to stop clear-cut logging. It's the only way we can be globally competitive. We can't afford to stop those trawlers that are dragging heavy weights across the bottom of the ocean because we can't compete with fishing fleets in other parts of the world. We can't afford to reduce greenhouse gases because it'll destroy the economy. So we elevate the economy above the very things that keep us alive. So let's put the eco back into economics. We seem to forget where that word came from. But if the economy is our highest priority, and certainly Mr. Romney and Mr. Obama indicated very strongly that was their highest priority, shouldn't we be asking a few fundamental questions like, what is an economy for? Are there no limits? What does all this growth in the economy mean to improve our lives? We keep saying it's got to have growth, growth, but why? What good is that doing for us? How much is enough? Are we happier with all this stuff? I mean, we're not asking the fundamental questions that we should if the economy is indeed our highest priority.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or 4 CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to hear more from David Suzuki. He spoke in Santa Fe, New Mexico in November 2012 in a talk hosted by the Lannan Foundation.
My great inspiration was Rachel Carson. And because of Rachel Carson, I became swept up in the environmental movement like millions of people around the world. And what I've, looking back over my life, being involved in environmental things, is that I was fortunate to be involved in a small way with a number of issues. For example, every time Congress threatened to put a rider on a bill that would allow Alaska to drill for oil in ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, I cranked up the Nature of Things and we did a show about that area from an ecological standpoint. And each time I like to think that our programs helped to beat back the threat of drilling in ANWR. We Don't clap right away, because I've got the bottom line is not what you'd think because of Sarah Palin. I joined with the First Nations, and there was a proposal to drill for oil in Heckett Strait, the narrow channel between Haida Gwaii and the mainland, and we stopped the proposal to drill for oil. There was a proposal to bring Alaskan oil down along through the coast of British Columbia on the way to Seattle or Washington, and we stopped that. We stopped a dam on the Site C on the Peace River. And Tara, my wife, and I joined with the Kayapo people in Brazil in a massive demonstration that stopped Brazil's program to build the Cararau Dam in Altamira, Brazil. These we celebrated as great triumphs. But today, 30 to 35 years later, we are fighting the same battles that we celebrated as victories 35 years ago. Sarah Palin told us it's drill, baby, drill. And Mr. Obama seems to be affected by that proposal. The proposal to drill for oil in Heckett Strait is back on. The dam at Site C on the Peace River and in Altamira are both being built now. And the pipeline from Alberta that will take the oil from the tar sands to the coast of British Columbia to load into supertankers. We banned supertankers, and now it's all back on the agenda. So what we celebrated as great victories were simply skirmishes that didn't fundamentally change the way that we see our relationship with the rest of the biosphere. We didn't shift the paradigm. And that's the reason many people are saying that the environmental movement, despite the enormous success in the first three decades, has fundamentally failed in what should have been our goal of shifting that paradigm. We were fighting for cleaner air, cleaner water, fighting to protect forests, fighting for a better future. But the problem today is that when there's a fight, there's always a winner or loser. And now, as we talk about the fate of the biosphere for humankind, I don't think that we can afford to have losers. And so the challenge, I believe, now is we've got to come together, and we now have to ask, can we begin from a position of agreement? Let's agree on the fundamental things on which we will build our platforms of politics or economics. So let's start by setting a bottom line that is dictated by the laws of nature. Thank you. We live in a world that is defined and shaped by laws of nature. Physicists tell us the speed of light puts a limit on how fast we can build a space rocket. We can't go faster than the speed of light. Nobody objects to that. You know, we live within that. We know that the law of gravity says you can't have an anti-gravity machine here on Earth. And we know the first and second laws of thermodynamics tell us that you can't build a perpetual motion machine. We all understand that. That's the world, the real world, that we live in. In biology, it's the same thing. We know that there are carrying capacities of ecosystems, that ecosystems can flourish as long as predators, you know, with living within that ecosystem do not undermine the ability of those ecosystems to sustain themselves over time. Human beings are the most powerful predators on the planet, and we live at the very top of the ecological food chain. So that we have to pay attention to what are the carrying capacities of the various ecosystems around the world we occupy. That has to be the case. And the most important thing for us to remember and agree on is that we are biological creatures. And our biological nature dictates what our most fundamental needs are. What delivers clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean food, and clean energy from the sun is the web of living things around the earth, what biologists call biodiversity. It's life itself that cleanses, replenishes, or creates the most fundamental needs that we have. To me, I defy any corporate leader, politician, anybody, even the Tea Party, I'm sure, would have to agree that as biological beings, air, water, soil, that photosynthesis and biodiversity have got to be in our best interests, our most fundamental needs that we have to protect and nourish. That's how we begin to build our system of needs, on which we then ask, how do we create an economy? Okay, I've spent a lot of time saying the dilemma, the problem that we face, is there a way out? And I see real change, real excitement happening in Latin America. Now, I know in America you don't like to hear this, but Cuba. Cuba is an example. When Russia blew apart, Cuba was in a tremendous dilemma. I mean, they had no oil. They couldn't even bring the food from the countryside into the city. They had no oil. And out of that came this incredible experience where Fidel Castro said, if you've got, you see an empty lot in the city and you're willing to grow food on it, take it. If you don't know how to do it, I'll send people to help you. If you don't have the tools, we'll give you the tools. And what came out of that terrible experience for Cuba was this amazing agricultural movement where urban agriculture now supplies 80% of the food in Cuba. That is, if you go to Havana, 80% of the food you eat in Havana is grown in Havana. It's fresh, organic, and it's grown by local city dwellers. That's an example that is spreading around the world. In Ecuador, which is an even more amazing experience, Ecuador has a president, Rafael Correa, who was trained, he has a PhD in economics from the United States. And the pride and joy of Ecuador is Yasuni National Park on the east side of the Andes in the headwaters of the Amazon. The Yasuni is the most biodiverse area on the planet. In 1 hectare of Yasuni National Park, they discovered more species of trees than in all of North America, from Mexico to Alaska. Anyway, the Ecuadorians are very, very proud of Yasuni. And a few years ago, they discovered there's oil under Yasuni National Park. $7 billion worth of oil. And Correa said, well, if we dig up the oil, we'll destroy the park. And if we then burn it, we'll simply add to global warming. So we're going to leave that oil in the ground. He said that we're a poor country, huge pressure on us to develop resources, to exploit various parts of nature. We will leave it in the ground. You know, and it humiliates me to live in one of the richest countries on the planet, Canada, and we just can't wait to dig it out. And we say, oh, yeah, yeah, but we'll have carbon capture and storage. Wait a minute, nature already did it. The tar sands oil is carbon captured and stored in the ground. Why do you want to dig it up, burn it, and then go, oh, we got to capture it, put it back in the ground. It's already down there. But no, we won't follow a poor country like Ecuador. What Correa did when he was elected, he said, we need a new kind of constitution. So if you elect me, I will revise the constitution. And guess what? In the constitution, they enshrined Pachamama, Mother Earth. In other words, rivers and forests and fish and birds have a constitutional right to exist. This is an economist, for heaven's sakes. And in the southern part of Ecuador is a river called the Vilcabamba River. One of the American couples that lives on the Vilcabamba noticed a couple of years ago that a road building company was dumping all of the gravel and sand and boulders into the river. So they then sued because Pachamama is guaranteed under the Constitution. They sued the road building company on behalf of Pachamama, the river. Now, because they're suing for the river, they can't claim any money. But what they can claim is the right for that river to exist. They won their suit, and that road company now has to restore the river to its original condition. Not bad. And finally, I will just mention this tiny kingdom of Bhutan. And I'm sure most of you have heard of Bhutan. Today, there are 500,000 people living in this kingdom that is surrounded by the Himalayan mountains. Now, they're squeezed by these two giants, these behemoths of China and India. And in order to keep from becoming political pawns between these two countries, they just hunkered down behind the mountains. So for literally centuries, nobody knew that Bhutan existed. In 1961, they realized that the world was changing and they had to find out what was going on. So they selected 100 kids at random and sent them out to schools in India to be educated, and then sent to schools like Oxford and Cambridge, Harvard and Stanford. And they came back and they began to send hundreds and hundreds of kids out to be educated in the real world. And when they came back to Bhutan, they said, it's really weird. They're all operating out there in the real world on this idea that development is all about growth in the GDP and stuff. Like, they were shocked. And they said, we don't want that kind of a, that's not what we think development is. Of course we need development, but just stuff, that's not what we want. And in April, on April 2, Jigme Tinley, the Prime Minister of Bhutan, went to the United Nations and introduced the only resolution Bhutan has ever introduced at the UN, that well-being of all life and happiness be the goal of governments. And this was immediately signed on up. 68 countries signed up immediately. But they said, well, what does it mean to be happy? You know, we think of happiness as this kind of joyous, oh, God, I feel great. And, you know, I just went skiing and I feel... No, that's not what he's talking about. It's a much deeper thing about, you know, feeling content or satisfied or being having a great sense of place in society and in the things you do. I mean, people said, you've got to define what it is in terms that any people would understand. What is well-being of life? What is happiness? How do you measure it? And how do you develop a strategy for governments to work towards that? And they've set up four working groups to work on various aspects of well-being and happiness. And they're all charged with completing their work in 2 years, at which time Bhutan will present this as a full-blown recommendation to the United Nations. And for me, who has long battled in the environmental movement, I believe this is the game changer. This is the paradigm shift. In fact, this gets us off the idea that the economy is everything. It's the goal or the end. No, the economy has to be a means of getting to some higher end. And this one, I believe, could be one. So there is opportunity there to begin a radical shift in the way that we see the world. Thank you very much.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to the Lannan Foundation for audio of that talk by David Suzuki. You can see video of his full speech and a question and answer session at our website, radioproject.org. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.